This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And this is the second in our two-day series of special programs about AIDS. Many legal and medical experts agree that in the absence of a cure or a preventive vaccine for AIDS, the best tool we have to contain the spread of the epidemic is education. Scientists know much more about the virus than they did last year at this time, and far more than they did when the virus was first identified in America in 1981. Medical experts want to reassure the American public that AIDS can't be spread through casual contact. They say you can only get AIDS if infected blood or sperm comes in direct contact with your bloodstream, as it can if you share IV needles or engage in anal or vaginal intercourse without a condom. Most of us rely on the mass media for our information about AIDS. Our understanding of AIDS and how it is spread is based on what we've seen, heard, and read through the mass media, from cover stories in Time and Newsweek to network TV specials to TV docudramas. Even dramatic series are sending us messages about AIDS. Just last week, one of the main characters on St. Elsewhere, Dr. Mark Harmon, left the hospital and the series after he was diagnosed as having the fatal illness. With me to evaluate the media coverage of AIDS and how it shaped the American reaction to the epidemic is Larry Gross, professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications of the University of Pennsylvania. He's co-authored many studies of television violence and TV portrayals of women and minorities and the impact of these portrayals on viewers. Gross co-chairs the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force and is a member of the AIDS Task Force. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Nice to be here.
Do you think that the media coverage of AIDS has set the stage for the American response?
Oh, yeah. I think the media coverage has informed and often misinformed almost everyone in America and around the world about AIDS because AIDS, by its nature, is something that very few people have now or will ever come into direct contact with.
The press has been called everything from sensitive to sensational, and they've been accused of not covering it enough, and then accused on dwelling on it obsessively. Do you think there's any truth in any of those accusations?
Well, yes, there's truth in all of them. It's really a matter of the sequence and the pattern. When the AIDS epidemic or the AIDS problem began to become clear, it was ignored by the media. And it was ignored, I think, for the fairly obvious reason that it dealt with a group that's ignored by the media and a problem seen as being associated with IV drug users at that time, although no longer with Haitians, and primarily with gay men, was certainly nothing that was of great interest to the population or the general public, and also was seen as sort of contaminated with questionable taste. So that it was not really paid attention to, and the problem I think that has existed both for the gay community and for the public health community, as I think a major player in the whole situation, has been in knowing how to deal with the sudden switch from famine to feast, from being ignored to being drowned in attention. Because the ways one learns to, or the way one thinks about situations when no one's paying attention, have to be rethought very quickly when suddenly everyone's paying attention. And let me just give you a specific example. During the period when the media began moving AIDS from a back page to a front page story, so that AIDS became by definition newsworthy, there was a tendency, and I think there still is, to run non-stories. That the media would use it as a teaser for the evening news, or put it on the cover of magazines or papers, when in fact there was no news, and when it was basically recycling something that had been published, in the New England Journal of Medicine, or not even that, and some doctors became sort of drawn into it, so that in one or two cases, press conferences were used as the form for breaking medical news, something that for good reason the medical profession frowns upon because, it needs to be evaluated a little more carefully before it becomes public. So all sides of this triangle of the gay community, the medical community, and the media, I think, need to learn how to deal with something of this sort.
Are there examples of specific broadcasts or print stories that you thought exemplified excellent media coverage of AIDS and exemplified poor coverage?
Well, all right, let me get the excellent out of the way faster and then make a general comment about the poor or the more coverage. I think one of the better examples of media coverage other than present company has been the most of the work done by the Philadelphia Inquirer, in particular Donald Drake's extensive coverage. Other work, they have a reporter currently doing stories on the sort of more social aspects of it, who is doing very good work. And in general, I think the Daily News in Philadelphia has also been very good. And they made a few slips, the Inquirer and the Daily News, I think, in the beginning, but nothing that would be seriously problematic. And I think also, to be fair, that the television and radio in Philadelphia have been reasonably good, although I've had problems with some of the things that they've done. But the larger issue of the problematic aspects or the unfortunate aspects, I think, have to do with fitting into two larger agendas or two larger sets of stereotypes. One is how the media deal with gays to begin with, and secondly, how they deal with issues having to do with sex. And then I'll start with the second one first. It seems to me that AIDS came along, you know, quite accidentally, because it was certainly unforeseen, at a point in American history when it fit into one of the dominant public agenda items, namely the counter-revolution against what is called the sexual revolution. The late 70s resurgence of social conservatism, or at least an attempt to impose social conservatism. And before AIDS, it was herpes. Herpes was all over the media. Time magazine announced that the party was over. It was time to cool it. And the image that was broadcast over and over again, whether it's in movies like Looking for Mr. Goodbar or in cover stories in Time and Newsweek about herpes, was that something vaguely called promiscuity can be fatal, that sex can kill you, that, you know, you thought it was okay. Now that we had the pill, and now that we had legalized abortion, and now that we had divorce, and now that we had women being more independent, but, you know, think again. Sex will get you killed, either by some crazed person you pick up in a bar or by some horrible disease, as herpes was being misrepresented, really, as being. So AIDS had a slot already to fit into when it came along. And that then fit very neatly with the dominant way in which the media deal with gay people when they deal with gay people, because most of the time they deal with gay people by not dealing with them, by ignoring them, by denying their presence or their existence for a variety of reasons. But when gay people have been visible in the media, rather similar to blacks for much of their of the 20th century in the mass media, they have been present either as victims or as villains. The villainous role is fairly common, for example, images of lesbians in movies or in television or in fiction in general, is a kind of sinister woman who's probably interested sexually in the beautiful young thing whom she's leering at or something, that kind of image. And gay men begin as victims of humor and end up as being villainous in other ways. So that for a long time, the image of gay men, and still today, if you listen to Eddie Murphy or someone like that, is the butt of a joke, that gay men are safe, particularly in a period in which you can increasingly, or in which it's harder and harder to find a group you can make fun of. Gays have played the role of being someone you could make fun of. So the victim-villain roles are, again, perfectly suited for something like AIDS, because here they can be the victim of this horrible new disease so that gay becomes nearly synonymous with AIDS victim in the public mind, and at the same time they're a threat. At the same time, it's this force that is going to unleash a disease on the rest of the world.
Well, you've accused the press of playing up the whole party's over idea that, well, you had your sexual revolution and, boy, it's backfiring now, so you'd better cut it out. But isn't that the way a lot of individuals are reacting to in kind of second guessing the
Well, but the individuals,
that they have?
The individuals, as I really meant when I said at the very beginning that most people, including most gay people, have not come into very much direct contact with AIDS, at least not anywhere near the extent to which they've come into contact with it through the media. And when I say the media, I'm not really exempting the gay media completely. Because to the extent that they are part of the same culture, I think they've very often played many of the same tunes in terms of their treatment. And when, I read two sentences from the Newsweek stories of the Newsweek cover story of the week that Rock Hudson died last August. It says, speaking of AIDS, and this is a bold type, so you don't even have to read much to see it when you open it, it will end the sexual revolution. You can take your chances with herpes or hepatitis B, but you can't take your chances with this. So that this is the final end. And in the same article, it says, the message goes out for everybody that the healthy sexual style is the single partner. Now, that's really the message here, is that monogamy, preferably for straight people in married relationships, that's the only safe. Up until now, we've been told it's the only moral sexual style, and we know that morality doesn't sell that well, but health is very much the thing of the 80s, and now we're being told it's the only healthy style.
The experts who've appeared on this show from epidemiology and from the medical profession all agree that the best way that we have now of containing the AIDS epidemic is through education about safe sex practices. And that's something that the media has been participating in to some extent. But there are some interesting dilemmas for the media when dealing with this particular kind of education. One is that to talk about safe sex, you have to talk about sex very explicitly. And it's something that, with the exception of programs like Dr. Ruth, the media tends to avoid. And that some readers actually, and listeners and viewers, find very objectionable. And the other thing is, you'd be talking about gay as well as heterosexual sexual practices, and that would be considered objectionable to hear by many people. So how do you think the media, the different forms of media, have done in trying to disseminate information about safe sex practices?
Well, I don't think they've done very well at all. I think in large part for the reasons that you've just mentioned. When you won't talk about something, it's hard to do things that require fairly explicit information. And I think that's one of the reasons, although, as I said, I think there are other reasons as well that feed into it. It's one of the reasons why the focus has been overwhelmingly on a concept vaguely described by the term promiscuity that gets used over and over again, because that is a relatively easy thing to say in media acceptable language, namely multiple partners or promiscuity and the sort of anonymous sex, other terms they could use, somehow being unsafe. Whereas in sort of technical fact, that's not really the issue. The issue isn't how many people you do something with, it's what you do. And as your listeners will have heard yesterday from Bob Sharar and others, AIDS is a very easy disease to avoid. By now, it's quite well known how it's transmitted and the implications for how to avoid it, even while having sexual relations, is available. The problem is that it's not going to be very effective if people aren't allowed to use the words or say them. And possibly Phil Donahue is the only context in which things will actually get said, or you said Dr. Ruth, but not enough people will hear it. I'll give you a very good example of a specific location where this is a problem that doesn't even require dealing with the media. Take prisons. Prisons are institutions in which there is an enormous amount of drug use and in which there's an enormous amount of sexual activity. But the officials, who very well know that there's an enormous amount of drug use and an enormous amount of sexual activity, are also completely unwilling to admit it in any way, and as a result are not very cooperative in efforts to educate the prison population, prisoners as well as guards, about these kinds of facts, because they feel that to do that would be to admit what everyone already knows but which they proceed to deny. The same kind of problem, in a less obvious, less extreme fashion, happens in the schools, public education, and it happens in the mass media in general. The kind of ostrich-like position that somehow assumes if you don't talk about it, it isn't there.
What kind of work do you think the media could be doing or should be doing from your perspective to disseminate information about how AIDS is and isn't transmitted and also about safe sex practices?
Well, I think realistically, the easiest thing to do within the present system as it operates with the media is for them to make a major effort to alert the public as, you know, about where they can get information through things like hotline numbers and means like that, is to make it as easy as possible for people who want information to locate it, even if they don't have to say it, you know, say those dreadful words on the air. But that in itself is not yet quite enough, because you have to recognize that some of the groups that are of greatest concern are people who are deep in the closet. And getting that information over the air doesn't mean that they're quite going to have the nerve to make a phone call. They might make a phone call, but to get a publication, to hold something that somebody might want to know why they have it, you know, that someone might find in their wallet or find in their pocket, is dangerous. The mass media have an enormous advantage, which is they reach into your living room in the context of regular programming, and you don't have to account to anybody for why you happen to be watching it.
AIDS has recently entered the arena of evening television drama. And just last week, watchers of St. Elsewhere saw Dr. Mark Harmon leave the hospital where he worked because he had gotten AIDS. And he got it not through any of the major ways that you're most likely to get it. He got it through intercourse with a woman, and medical experts seem to agree that that's one of the definitely less likely ways of getting it. And
so they got it from a scriptwriter.
But it's interesting that in some of these TV shows, they've given people very exceptional ways of getting AIDS. And I have a quote here from the producer of St. Elsewhere. He was quoted in an AP story as saying, "By making it heterosexual, we make it more common and less easily dismissible." And I wonder how you'd react to that, because, I mean, he was making a defense for doing it this way as a politically correct and a socially, you know, morally correct way of doing it, so that more people would empathize with it and feel that it was their concern.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that with his assessment, and I think it's unfortunate in a variety of ways. The first conclusion I would reach, as I said earlier, is I think this fits in with the larger media and cultural agenda of rolling back the sexual revolution. It's as if they're saying or thinking, well, as long as we keep talking about AIDS as a gay or IV drug user problem, most people aren't going to see that as their problem, so they won't get the point. The point being, sex is dangerous, or, you know, promiscuous sex is dangerous. So the sort of underlying lesson of, you know, you're at risk when you screw around, I think may in fact be dishonest or at least disingenuous. It's not really the problem. I think the question also of assuming that this is how you're going to get people to care, or this is why people should care because it can happen to them, has been one of the problems that has run through the media treatment. The Inquirer, which I complimented earlier, in the very early days, going back now to 1981, when AIDS was just emerging, the first time that AIDS moved from the back pages to the front page of the Inquirer was a headline that said, "Heterosexuals can get it too." I don't remember the exact words, but the import was, "AIDS is spreading to the straight community. Now it's a real story. You know, now it's important." And that has tended to run through, just as there's been a tendency to use a term, and this is now another quote from the Newsweek story, showing a picture of a mother and children, straight woman and children, as saying and referring to them as blameless victims. The implication that there are people out there who are blameless because they didn't do sex, and sex, of course, is what makes you guilty.
Another way, though, of looking at the issue of portraying the disease as being just within certain communities, is that the more you see it as a disease that other people are susceptible to, the more involved they'll feel with issues like research funds that are available, civil liberties questions that are raised, because the more you can distance yourself and say, I am not part of this high-risk population, the less that you can care, the less you want your tax dollars to go to support it and so on. So, you know, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's a very difficult question. I'm a little reluctant, though, to engage in or encourage what I consider fundamentally dishonest or at least disingenuous tactics in order to achieve ends which I'm interested in. I think those can backfire. I think the truth is a good enough argument in this case, and I don't want to encourage sort of misleading ways of approach. I think that the part of the problem that the American public have to face is that a serious disease that affects a fairly large part of the population requires attention, requires help. And I think that that it needn't be sort of overhyped as coming to your neighborhood soon in order to accomplish that, in part because the coming to your neighborhood soon is more likely to fan the flames of bigotry and discrimination that David was talking about than it is to lead people to write their senator to spend more money for research. I'm not unconcerned about the fact that AIDS is getting attention all out of proportion to its actual threat to the public health. There are, let's say, 17 or 18,000 diagnosed AIDS cases so far in this country, and there are somewhere between 6,500 and 7,000 people who have died of it, which is certainly significant. On the other hand, according to vital statistics, sort of government statistics, 45,000 people die in the United States every year from pneumonia. 50,000 women die of ovarian, uterine, and breast cancer. Lung cancer and emphysema kill more than 100,000 people a year. And 9,000 people die of alcohol-related cirrhosis of the liver. Now, there are many different kinds of life-threatening diseases that we all hear about and some that we don't hear much about. What's peculiar about AIDS is not that it's America's worst public health problem, which is what it was called in the media, or there's another phrase here from it, something about the health crisis of the century or something. It just isn't.
But cirrhosis of the liver isn't contagious, and neither is...
Neither is AIDS very much either. I mean, it is contagious, but it's not nearly as contagious as it is being represented. I lived through, I'm old enough to remember the polio panics of the late 40s and the early 50s, and it has somewhat of the same quality of an over-excited or overextended hysteria. And my analysis, to the extent that I think one can make one, is in large part what I've already said, is that it feeds into an ongoing social, moral, and public agenda, namely the morality wars of the late 70s and early 80s.
I'd like to, at this point, open up the telephones and invite our listeners to call. And you might want to call. Joining us for this part of the program, by the way, will be David Weber, the legal director for the Advocacy Committee of the Philadelphia AIDS Task Force. And he spoke with us a little earlier. And also with me is Larry Gross, a professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications. He was just speaking. And he's co-chair of the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force and a member of the AIDS Task Force. If you have any questions you'd like to ask either of them about the media or about civil liberties questions raised by the AIDS epidemic, our number is 923-2774. Or if you'd like to address the question of how you feel AIDS is affecting your life, you're welcome to do that too. And our phone number is 923-2774. Before we open up the phones, Larry, a couple of other questions for you. Now, as I mentioned, you also co-chair the Lesbian and Gay Task Force. Do you think that the AIDS epidemic has been increasing homophobia, and I know that the task force also recently issued a report on violence against and harassment of lesbians and gays in Philadelphia.
But there's no question that it has. I think the main form that it's taken is that it has, it has sort of been like one more push to people who are likely to commit acts of aggression or discrimination against gays. And I think even more important, it has sort of change the public atmosphere in which these occur. The main problem that faces gay people in terms of violence and discrimination is not primarily the relatively few people who commit these acts, but the silent majority who do not stop them through their condemnation. And the problem with AIDS is it gives the bigots another stick to hit people with, and it scares the silent majority, so they're less likely to say something about it. It sort of becomes like this state representative we just heard. It gives people a chance to wrap themselves in some flag or banner of morality and to protect themselves from charges of bigotry. So it definitely has that effect.
How well do you think the Philadelphia gay community has organized around the issue of AIDS?
Philadelphia community has done very well. I'd say the gay community in all over the country has organized very well. The advantage in Philadelphia is that people were prepared very quickly, that beginning in the fall of 81, there was organization long before there were any real cases in Philadelphia, so that by the time cases began to develop, there were mechanisms in place for dealing with them, and they've been very effective.
One last question, and then we'll open up the phones. Earlier on the show, we heard from Dennis Altman, who made a case for not seeing AIDS as a gay disease or a gay issue. To what extent do you think it's appropriate to treat AIDS in the media or, you know, for you in your view, to treat AIDS as a gay issue or a gay disease?
Well, I think in part, as I was saying earlier, you have to see it within the context of the way the culture is dealing with issues of sexuality and morality. I also would support the argument that Dennis has been making, that as a medical and social service issue, it needs to be understood and interpreted in light of the extraordinarily backward and inadequate system of health insurance and health services that this country has and that most Americans don't even realize is as poor as it is.